we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
In the last few shows, we've discussed health insurance and ways to receive medical care for less money overall. This last topic dives into Medicare. Welcome to America Out Loud Pulse, always a beat ahead. I'm Dr. Marilyn Singleton. Medicare accounts for 20% of healthcare expenditures and is 13% of total federal spending. Medicare is the second largest program in the federal budget, second only to the Social Security program. Hard to believe, isn't it? And you know how much Medicare costs? Just last year, $767 billion. Wow. And Social Security, $1.1 trillion. Now, for all of us who throw around these numbers, and they throw them around all the time, remember that a trillion is 1,000 billion and a billion is 1,000 million. So that's a lot of money. In 2021, Medicare gave benefits to 19% of the population. That's like one-fifth of the population. By 2030, it's predicted that over 1 in 5 Americans will be older than 65 years. That means they're going to be on Medicare. So we know the expenses are going to rise with the increased enrollment. The prices will rise, the increased use of care, because now people with chronic conditions live longer. So now it is imperative that policymakers arrive at viable changes to the program that don't sacrifice seniors at the altar of cost savings. You know, these days people say we can't agree on anything. They say we're too divided. Now, in my view, of course, most of us want the same goals, but just have different ideas on how to achieve them, by the way. One thing we all want is for seniors not to struggle in retirement after they've worked so hard for all these years. Another is we don't want to kill off our seniors with rationing and medical care. And we all want shared decision-making for seniors. We don't want somebody who doesn't know them coming in and deciding to pull the plug. But with Medicare, there is rationing going on, but it's more subtle and it's behind the scenes. More and more seniors shifted to the Medicare Advantage program. It had managed care, fixed allotments to the doctors and other professionals, restricted prescription meds, and the Affordable Care Act actually decreased payments to this program. What's going to happen to seniors? Well, my guest today will discuss his dedication to improving life for seniors and his ideas for improving Medicare and healthcare overall. He'll tell us about Medicare's general rules and pitfalls for patients and how to improve it. Mr. Steve Cohen is a partner with Pollack Cohen Law Firm in New York. His practice epitomizes the intersection of law, policy, and journalism, with a little politics thrown in for good measure. This is such a great story. For 35 years before going to law school, Mr. Cohen was a successful publishing executive, including at Time and Scholastic Magazine. He's the author of 7 books, including 3 bestsellers. Aren't I lucky to have him today? He attended the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis and graduated from Brown University, just like Amy Carter, for those of you who remember Jimmy Carter's daughter, and New York Law School, cum laude. He co-chaired Hillary Clinton's White House Task Force on Early Childhood Literacy, the prescription for reading. Welcome, Steve Cohen.
Thank you, Marilyn. Nice to be here.
Well, I just have to ask you, you have to tell the story, because so many people think that we have one life, one profession, might have a couple of jobs, but you just do the same thing. So I think we all have a lot inside that's just kind of screaming to get out. So I want to know how you went from publishing to law as an old coot, as I understand.
Well, I was an old, I am an old coot, and I was 58 years of age when I went to law school. And I think the moral of the story is be careful who you go drinking with. You may wind up in law school. And the true story, and that's literally what happened. I was at a party. It was just after Christmas and New Year's at a friend's house here in Manhattan. And I had a drink in my hand. My wife was at the other side of the room, so she couldn't keep tabs on me too carefully. And I was talking to a woman, and I was telling her about an article I had just written. I had just finished serving on a jury here in New York, federal jury, on a terrorism trial. Big front page news, terrorism trial. And I wrote about it. In fact, I thought I was going to get off jury duty by saying to the judge, "Judge, I'm a writer. You really don't, you know, this case sounds fascinating. You don't want me on a jury writing about this." And this federal judge said, well, you know you can't write about it while the trial is going on. Oh, I know that, Your Honor. But afterwards, I'm going to write about it. He said, wait, let me ask a question. Can you be fair? Well, of course I can be fair, Your Honor. You don't want me. If you can be fair, you're on this jury. Just don't write about it until it's over. Well, I was on the jury, and it was absolutely fascinating. I'm telling this woman at this party the story behind the story. And she said to me, "Are you a lawyer?" I said, no, I just dress like one. She said, "Come on, don't be a wise guy. Forgive me, my wife's over there at the other side of the room. She will confirm I am a wise guy. But I'll tell you the truth. Our youngest kid is going off to college. We're about to be empty nesters. And if I didn't have to take the LSAT, the test that you need to get into law school, I'd go to law school now." And this woman looked at me as if I was totally nuts. And she said, "At your age?" I said, "Yeah, at my age." "Fine, you're accepted." "Excuse me?" "You're accepted. School starts on August 15th. Write a check and show up." "Excuse me, who are you?" I asked her. And she said, "I'm the dean of New York Law School." She called my bluff in front of other people.
And I love it.
And I did not have to take the LSAT. I did go that August 15th. And I absolutely loved it. It probably made me 20 years younger, certainly 20 pounds heavier. And, you know, I had to learn how to learn all over again, because I hadn't used many parts of my brain, literally, and certainly not like that, of reading hundreds of pages of cases every weekend. And it was interesting. I went at night. And one of the most important lessons I learned going to law school at night was what a jerk I had been for many years. I had been an adjunct professor of marketing and entrepreneurship in various master's and MBA programs in New York, at Fordham, at NYU. I taught in the summers out at Stanford. And I never realized what a jerk I had been to these evening students who I was teaching. I was a pretty good professor and I was relatively entertaining, but I was unbelievably demanding. And here's the real thing, inflexible. I didn't have any appreciation at all what it was like to be an evening student of people who had full-time jobs during the day, going to school four nights a week, doing their homework over the weekend, you know, juggling family, a relationship, and job. It's hard. And I had no appreciation until I tried to do it, and I did it. But the stakes, it was much easier for me because the stakes were different. I had a career. I had been relatively successful. I have this enormous respect for night students. And I go out of my way to certainly interview and try to hire evening students because they show a maturity and judgment and grit that lots of other students don't. So I'm a really big fan. And if I ever go back and teach again, I'll try to be more understanding of evening students. And I have enormous respect for them.
Well, certainly if somebody takes the time to go back, go to school and go in the evening, you know they're motivated. It's not like kids who just go to college because there's nothing else to do and they're biding their time for 4 years. So I want to know.
I agree.
Okay. So then after you got out of law school, what kind of law firm did you seek out, or did they seek you out, or how did you get in the firm?
It was fascinating for me because, you know, I decided I was going to take the bar exam because I'm a fairly competitive person, but I also decided I was only going to take it once. And if I flunked, then okay, I'll go off and do what I was doing. But I had a secret weapon. And you mentioned Amy Carter, but there's a more famous graduate of Brown University who sadly is no longer with us, named John Kennedy Jr. And John Kennedy Jr. was a number of years, you know, younger than me. But he then went to NYU Law School, and he unfortunately failed the bar two or three times. But he passed it on the third or fourth time. And I said, ha, how did he do that? And I found out that he had a different tutoring service. He actually found a tutor for the time that he passed the bar. I found that same tutor. And I said, if he could do it for John Kennedy, I'm a bigger challenge. He can hopefully do it for me. And I found that tutor and I passed the bar. And I went to work for a law firm called Kramer, Dilloff, Livingston and Moore. And I thought about other things. I had other offers, particularly to stay in the publishing arena. I came out of publishing, as you mentioned, and I had a really good offer to continue doing publishing deals, buying and selling publishing firms. And I said, I don't want to do that. And I knew, however, this firm, I knew Tom Moore and Judy Livingston. They are husband and wife, and it's a 12-lawyer firm. And I knew them because Tom Moore, I was a juror. I'm the only person you're probably ever going to meet who hasn't tried to get out of jury duty when called. And I've actually served on four juries through verdict. And I've written about three of them. And the first one that I wrote about was, I think, in 1989. I was called to jury duty on a medical malpractice case. And that case lasted 7 weeks. And we, as the jury, we returned what was then the largest verdict in New York history for a medical malpractice case. And I wrote a cover story for New York Magazine about the experience. Well, I kept in touch with Tom Moore, who was the plaintiff's lawyer, because I interviewed him, I interviewed the judge, I interviewed the defense lawyers, but he won. So he was the most forthcoming, and we stayed in touch over the years regularly. We became friends. And after I graduated, he asked me, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to be you. I don't really want to practice medical malpractice, but you are one of the top trial lawyers in the United States. And he gave me a shot, and I went to work for 3 years at his and Judy's firm as an associate. And I learned very quickly I did not want to do medical malpractice, but I learned about being a good trial attorney. And they gave me the opportunity to explore other areas. And I represented pro bono people outside of the medical malpractice field, and they let me do it. And one of the areas that I learned about from Tom was something called the False Claims Act. And the False Claims Act became a law because of Abraham Lincoln's insistence in 1863. The Union Army was spending a lot of money purchasing, you know, the essentials that they need, you know, in the Civil War. And there were two instances that got Lincoln thinking about this area. The first was that the Union Army ordered 400,000 pair of leather boots. The boots were delivered, the government paid for them, and the first time the soldiers put them on and marched across a muddy field, the boots disintegrated. They were made not of leather, but of cardboard. That's okay, that's not great. The second experience was more serious. The Army ordered 5 million rounds of ammunition. They were paid for and delivered. And when soldiers put them into their rifle, nothing happened because the bullets didn't have gunpowder. They had sawdust. And Lincoln said, we've got to get ahead of this. And one way to do that is to give insiders, whistleblowers, both protection from retaliation and an incentive, a financial incentive for blowing the whistle. And that became the False Claims Act. And to this day, that False Claims Act is in practice. The federal government collects about $7 billion a year in penalties, with about 20% of it going to fewer than 200 whistleblowers a year. A lot of money. It's an important tool for both the federal government and the state government. And anyway, Tom Moore and Judy Livingston let me pursue a False Claims Act case, and it was against a health insurance company. And I did that, and after 3 years, I went to Tom and Judy and said, I really don't want to practice medical malpractice law. And I left on the best of terms, and I met a young attorney named Adam Pollack, who had been an assistant attorney general here in New York, on the whistleblower case that I had developed at Tom and Judy's firm. And we worked side by side. We weren't when you bring a whistleblower, you do it on behalf of the government, but the government has its own lawyers. Anyway, I met Adam and we became friends. And he decided to leave after another 3 years, the attorney general's office. And we talked and we started Paula Cohen 5 years ago. And we said, we're going to do three things here at this firm. We're going to do whistleblower law, we're going to do class actions, and we're going to do something called public impact. And I'll give you two examples of public impact because it's relevant to the discussion we're about to have about Medicare. My other partner, Chris Leung, is the attorney who figured out and brought the case that resulted in banning menthol cigarettes. And menthol cigarettes have now been banned. They're still on the market for a little longer. But Congress 15 years ago said to the FDA, okay, you got to do away with flavored cigarettes because the tobacco companies were marketing bubblegum flavor and vanilla and rum and lots of other flavors. And they also had a very big business, about $8 billion a year in menthol. And the FDA acted very quickly on the flavored cigarettes, but they dragged their feet on menthol. And there was obviously a lot of lobbying by the tobacco companies. And Chris figured out how to get the FDA to do what Congress told it to do, finally. And he won that case about a year and a half ago. And now menthol cigarettes are finally about to be banned because they are more dangerous than regular cigarettes. And they have a disproportionate.
Why are they more dangerous than regular cigarettes? Let our listeners know.
There are two reasons. First is that the menthol masks the harshness of the tobacco, and so people smoke them more. And second, there's actually a chemical reaction from the menthol with some of the chemicals in the cigarettes that exacerbates the tendency towards causing cancer. Mm-hmm. So they are just more dangerous, and it is a big business, and they're finally going to be outlawed.
I'm going to stop you there because we have to take a break, and this will bring us in to kind of, in a sense, you've made it unboring by telling a personal story of this, but some of the nuts and bolts of Medicare and why it matters if you have Medicare Advantage versus a supplemental program with regular Medicare. So we'll go into all those details after the break. What I'm going to talk about, I usually don't talk about this first, but somehow talking about Medicare people at ground zero and getting sick just makes me feel like I have to talk about Cofix RX right now. Cofix RX is a nasal spray, and by its name, Cofix, it's something that came out during COVID. As we know, and if you don't know, I'll tell you now, about 95% of the illnesses we get, these respiratory illnesses, come to us through the nose. You breathe it in, and then it gets down to the lungs and the virus, or if you're unfortunate enough to get bacterial pneumonia, it gets all the way down to the lungs. Well, Cofix is a mixture of povidone iodine, which was discovered, 2.5 or so years ago, to kill the COVID virus. And but people were mixing it themselves. And so this was made by some doctors in the United States, manufactured in the United States. And it's the right dose of iodine, vitamin D, and some xylitol, all of which help combat viral illness. So you squirt it up your nose a couple times a day. I always do it before I go out shopping or if I go to a big public space, just for a little extra protection. And I just think it's worth a try. We've got a little button for it right on the page, right on our Pulse page. And click it on. You can read more about it. Don't just take my word for it. And give it a try. I think you'll feel a little bit safer. We've got to do everything we can in this flu season and with all these bugs going around. We got to do whatever we can to help ourselves out.
All right. You've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
And so we have Steve here who's doing this public impact law, which fascinates me because we need folks like him. You know, what did Shakespeare say? First kill all the lawyers. Well, there's some lawyers we don't want to kill. And we need somebody to fight for the little guy. So go on with your story about having the people put from regular Medicare with a supplemental policy onto Medicare Advantage.
Well, thanks, Mar. I will. I'm going to try Cofix RX. Thank you.
I have to say, I go out in public a lot. You know, I go to Walmart, busy places, and I always give myself a squirt before or after, and you can use it a couple times a day. And you do everything you can to stay healthy. None of us want to get sick. So enough of that.
So now let me be really candid. So I am of Medicare age. I have Medicare. And nobody understands Medicare. Nobody. One of my very best friends is a Harvard College graduate, an NYU Law School graduate, passed the bar, practiced for a few years, just turned 65, and he said, I don't have a clue. How does this work? What are my choices? How is Medicare supplemental different from Medicare Advantage? What are all these moving parts? And when the retirees came to me a year and a half ago, I actually had to start sorting out so I could explain to others and potentially to a judge who is not of Medicare age, how these moving parts fit together. And you put your finger on it earlier. You know, 19% of the population has Medicare. And $767 billion in federal money spent this past year on Medicare. Okay, so in the mid-1960s, the Lyndon Johnson administration pushes through Great Society, and Medicare is an essential part of that. And Medicare comes in parts. And they started with, legitimately and logically, Part A and Part B. And Part A covers hospitalization. And Part B doctors out of the hospital. And doctors in the hospital. But you said this hospitalization part A and doctors part B. And the federal government said, okay, we're going to pay for all of part A. And we're going to charge people based on their income or their previous income, a sliding scale monthly, which is now about on average, you know, it's about $170 a month for most people, but it can go much higher if you're a, you know, a multimillionaire, to pay for part B, the doctor part. And the federal government pays for the rest. Okay, so now we're covered. But what does Medicare really cover? Well, what it covers is 80% of the cost of hospitalization, or 80% of the cost of the doctor's bill. Now, insurance companies, very smart. Soon after the creation of Medicare, insurance companies said, hey, individual, the government is paying for the first 80% of those hospital and doctor bills. You're going to be responsible for the next 20%. Why don't you buy an insurance policy? And we're going to call that supplemental insurance. And they've been doing it now for over 40 years. So you can go out in the marketplace if you're Medicare eligible, i.e. over 65, or have a disabled condition that allows you to get Medicare earlier, as these first responders have been able to get. And you can buy a plan. And right now, it depends on where you are and how big the deductible is of that other 20%. You can buy a plan for, let's say, $200 per month. Okay, I understand it's $200. Now, it doesn't cover any prescription drugs. And prescription drugs are known as Medicare Part D. And they came about in the George W. Bush administration. And again, I, an individual, can go out in the marketplace, and lots of different insurance companies offer policies for drugs. And that might cost me anywhere from $50 a month to $400 a month, depending on the types of drugs that I need. If I'm relatively healthy, I can probably get an inexpensive plan for about $50 a month. And if I have certain conditions, I'm going to pay a lot more. Okay, so that's A, B, and D. And most people will logically say, excuse me, you jumped over C. And in fact, I did. Because C was created in the mid-1990s, and it actually came out of Hillary Clinton's healthcare initiative when her husband was president. Remember, she had a healthcare initiative that was looking to reform healthcare in many ways. And ultimately, Obamacare looks a lot like what Hillary Clinton her task force was talking about in the mid-90s, but never got passed. But one thing that did come out was this concept of a public-private partnership involving Medicare and private insurance companies, which has been dubbed Medicare Advantage, Part C. And Medicare Advantage is exactly, it's a privately offered insurance plan paid for mostly by the federal government. And what the federal government does is say, okay, you Medicare eligible senior, you can have traditional Medicare A and B, and you can either buy a supplemental plan for the other 20%, or you don't have to, if you know, it's your choice. And if you want a drug plan, you can go out, or you can try something called Medicare Advantage that will combine A, B, and D. And there are lots of different flavors by lots of different insurance companies. In fact, if you turn on the TV right now, because we're in what's known as the open enrollment period for Medicare, you will see TV commercials starring Joe Namath, William Shatner, Jimmy Walker, promising this, you know, no premium Medicare Advantage plan. Just call this number on your screen right now. And that is a type of the various offerings of low-end Medicare Advantage plans, which have no additional premium that the individual has to pay. Many other offerings from insurance companies of Medicare Advantage do require someone to pay a premium, and that premium can run from $50 a month to $300 a month. And again, it depends on, do you want to see your particular doctor, Or are you happy with an HMO where you don't have a particular principal care physician? So anywhere from $50 to $300 a month, in addition to what the government is paying the insurance company, what the government pays the insurance company, is called a capitated rate, a per person amount of money, which for easy calculation, the government, federal government, is paying each insurance company $1,000 per month per person. And what they say to the insurance company is, for that $1,000, you, the insurance company, have to pay all the bills, less some sort of deductible upfront, deductible. There might be a small copay, but you have to pay all the hospital and doctor bills. And if you keep people healthy, you're going to have a bigger profit. There's already a small profit built in, but if you keep people healthy out of the hospital, which costs a lot of money, you, the insurance company, can make more money. And it was a really interesting concept when it was developed in the mid, it was a combination of managed care, private initiative, public money, and it seemed to make a lot of sense to a lot of people. The insurance company said, hey, this is great. And they figured out how to make lots of money. One way, as you mentioned earlier, Marilyn, was by rationing access to healthcare services. Because what they figured out, the original promise was, hey, we're going to get these old people to be healthier, stay out of the hospital, by getting them to do certain things. Eat smarter, get more exercise, go to the doctor for checkups. And what they found in reality is, people like me, it's hard to get me to change my habits. I'm not going to necessarily eat better. I'm not sure I'm going to get more exercise. I really don't like going to the doctor very much. So the insurance company said, ha, that's a hard way to make money. An easier way is something we're going to call utilization review or prior authorization. And what they built into their, remember, they're offering the plan. They run it. It's not Medicare running the plan. It's the private insurance company. They built in hurdles. They built in bureaucracy that doctors have to go through, get prior authorization. They may have prescribed a test or a procedure or physical therapy or a drug, but the insurance company becomes the gatekeeper. The medical gatekeeper. They determine medical necessity. And they get in between the doctor and patient and say, yes, I understand the doctor has prescribed this MRI or that procedure, but we have to be sure it's really medically necessary. And you can't get it until we say, we, the insurance company, say you can get it. As a result, doctors are even more than patients because they have to deal with the insurance company first. The patient just hears, wait, you can't go for that MRI yet until the doctor gets the prior authorization, the pre-approval from the insurance company before he can get the MRI. And the doctors have to jump through hoops to get that prior authorization. And as a result, there are lots of delays and there are lots of denials of care being imposed by the insurance company. And what does it do? That savings goes right to their bottom line. And there are enormous problems with prior authorization. So, and as a result, lots of doctors choose not to participate in Medicare Advantage plans, whereas almost all doctors participate in Medicare. Many, many don't participate in Medicare Advantage. And I'll give you a personal example.
Well, I want to just interject here because we had a guest on a couple of weeks back, Dr. Kim Korba, who was talking about direct primary care. And one of the biggest things that she likes and the patients like about direct primary care is no prior authorization. And one of the things that patients don't realize that there's a lot of time spent. And when we talk about cash practices and stuff, this is one of the things the doctors don't have to pay for if they're not in one of these programs, because that's a whole office worker that has to sit there on the phone trying to extract either money or get to somebody who denied the care and get an appeal going, on and on. It is a lot of bureaucracy sometimes for a simple procedure. You are so right, Steve, with what you're saying. So listeners, pay attention here.
What we found in New York when we actually brought suit against New York City, because New York City was being really tricky about what they were trying to do. They said to these 250,000 senior citizens and disabled first responders, you can either accept, we're moving you automatically into this Medicare Advantage plan, and I'll explain why in a second, or you can keep your traditional Medicare with the supplemental plan. But if you do keep it, you have to pay the $200 a month premium. Now, you know, 250,000 retirees are pretty upset about this. Most of them want to keep their doctors. Most of them like the fact they don't have to go through prior authorization hurdles. And what they found very quickly was that in New York City alone, fully 10% of their existing doctors who accepted Medicare would not accept this new Medicare Advantage plan. 10% said, nope, no way. We're just not going to accept it. It's not worth it to us. We're sorry. And as a result, many of these senior citizens were saying, hey, I'm going to lose my continuity of care. Just as I said, and I put down my credit card because I could afford it. I want the doctor who operated on me, whom I know, to check me out. They were understandably fearful of a loss in continuity of care. And so we brought a lawsuit against New York City, because that's who had made the decision. And we won. And then we won again 2 weeks ago, the appellate decision. But it isn't over, because what did the insurance company and the city decide to do? Well, the judge ruling in our favor said to the city and the insurance company, you can't threaten these people. There's a law that, you know, to make them pay for their own insurance. They are entitled by law. We never even got to the contract questions. They are entitled by law to having their health insurance paid for in retirement. So you got to pay for it. Do not pass any of the cost along to any of these retirees. So the city kept paying the $200 a month for the premium. And they did something a little tricky. They started charging copays. No, it's only $15 every time someone went to a doctor or got a test or went for physical therapy. But $15 for people on fixed incomes, small pensions, adds up. And it has added up to over $55 million in copays since January. And we just brought a new lawsuit against the city and the insurance company for imposing what the judge said they couldn't impose.
Well, when we get back, this is an incredible tale. We're going to hear the end of this. And I'd like you to give an example about holdups with prior authorizations so people can be aware of specific circumstances that come up. Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, and iHeart. So just make it easy. Bookmark americaoutloud.com/pulse.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep is infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's fast-paced digital age makes it tougher. You're not alone. Poor sleep affects over 70% of us. The CDC even labeled insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created REM Sleep to help you quickly fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake refreshed. Unlike other supplements that don't work, REM Sleep is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients, supporting all four stages of sleep using calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Over 1,000 reviews with an average star rating of over 4.4 proves it works. Take back your sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
The spirit of American liberty and justice is woven into the soul of America Out Loud. We are the voice of a nation, the American nation, that is. This is Malcolm Out Loud. I invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com, where the fight for liberty and justice continues. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Well, one thing that isn't easy is getting stuff done with Medicare. So I'm glad we have some lawyers on our side like Steve Cohen. So continue on with the New York story.
Well, I'm going to actually segue a bit, Marilyn. I'm going to answer something you asked about that I think is important, and that is to give a good example of the dangers of prior authorization. About 5 years ago, I got a call from a man who said he was a retired New York City detective, and he had his wife was 47 years old and was a teacher. They were living in North Carolina now in his retirement, and they had a 15-year-old son. And he said to me, well, 4 months ago, she had pain in her leg, a little more than 4 months ago, 6 months ago now, forgive me. 6 months ago, she had pain in her leg. And being the responsible one, she went to her physician who examined her, took an x-ray, read the x-ray and said, I don't see anything. What I want you to do is have 6 weeks of physical therapy twice a week. You can try Tylenol, you can try Advil. Let me get the prior authorization for the physical therapy, but I want you to really do it and you know, try hot compresses, cold packs. Tell me, but do the physical therapy. And being the responsible one, she does. 6 weeks, twice a week, physical therapy. She goes back, and they got the prior authorization for that fairly quickly. And she returns to the doctor who says, how are you feeling? And she says, I'm feeling worse. He takes another x-ray. He says, I want you to have, and says, I still don't see anything. I want you to have an MRI. And he calls the same insurance company, and the insurance company says, no, it's not medically necessary until she's finished 6 weeks of physical therapy. The doctor, to his credit, said, guys, not only had she finished the 6 weeks of physical therapy, you approved it and paid for it. And they said, oh, you don't like our decision? You can appeal. And so the doctor goes through the hurdles and rigmarole of appealing the denial of the MRI and the appeal, and it takes 38 days. He's trying to get someone a peer. Remember, they have doctors usually making these initial decisions, but on appeal, it's supposed to have, you know, in this case, it was an orthopedist who was going to make the decision, who was going to evaluate the x-rays and the symptoms and look at the records. And he can't get a conversation with a qualified doctor. It takes 38 days. And the insurance company finally reverses itself. She gets her MRI, and what does it show? A sarcoma, cancer in her hip. Goes immediately to one of the best cancer hospitals in New York, Memorial Sloan Kettering. the doctors do their tests and they examine her and they say, had you come to us a month sooner, we would have treated you just with chemo. Now, we're still going to use chemo, but first we're going to amputate your leg, your hip, and your pelvis. And they did.
Oh my goodness.
Because of a delay of 38 days. Now, sadly, she passed, and the widower, the husband, brought a lawsuit on her behalf and the family and the 15-year-old's behalf against the insurance company because they said, hey, you're not entitled to an MRI until you've done 6 weeks of physical therapy. And they had already approved and she had completed. All they had to do was look at their own records. And they would have seen that she had completed the physical therapy. Believe it or not, now, we lost on a motion to dismiss in the trial court. And the trial judge said, this is tragic, but there is no law that holds an insurance company accountable in New York State, which is where the suit was brought. There is no law in New York State, and no federal law, that holds an insurance company accountable when they commit medical malpractice. And I have to dismiss, you know, get the legislature to change it. Well, the bottom line legally is that we have appealed the case and it is up before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm arguing it on February 10th of next year. And we are arguing that public policy requires, and case law that discusses public policy requires, insurance companies be held accountable. Doctors, dentists, nurses, hospitals are all held accountable when they do something wrong. You can't let insurance companies who have this important gatekeeping role. It's not just about money. There's a gatekeeping role that other courts have said that insurance companies actually have. And we're hoping the Court of Appeals agrees with us and says, yes.
I sure hope so, because see, this is one of the things that as physicians, we totally object to. You can't do things cookie cutter. I remember once when it was real late at night and I was doing a case with a resident, and earlier in the day, I had done an elective aortic aneurysm surgery, and they were bringing the patient back to the OR, and I looked at him, and other than him bleeding, I said, something about him doesn't look right. And I got some bloods drawn and his potassium was just way off kilter. And the resident looked at me and he said, how did you know? To this day, he calls me the Swami. He said, how did you know? And I just said, practicing for 25 years, there's some things that you can just tell. And that's completely taken out of the equation. That doctor who saw that woman knew something didn't smell right. The insurance company is not seeing that patient. If you could see my stomach right now, it would be in knots every time I think about this. When I was in pediatric ICU, George Gregory, the fellow who invented CPAP, would go around and look at the babies and, you know, he'd just say, that one doesn't look right. And, you know, 99% of the time, his total being able to totally look at this little baby gave a feeling that an insurance company could never be able to describe. And it's criminal that they insert themselves like this.
No, we agree. So now what do we do? Is the question. Now, you know, one of the things we haven't discussed is why was New York City so intent on moving these 250,000 retirees from Medicare traditional with supplemental insurance to Medicare Advantage? And the answer, not surprisingly, is money. Because the supplemental insurance plan, about $200 per person per month, is paid for by New York City as part of its retirement package for former employees. Medicare Advantage is completely paid for by the federal government. So by moving all these people, the city would, I'm not going to use the word save because, you know, local governments, local politicians never save money. They just spend it on something else. But they would find almost about $500 million a year in found federal money, Medicare Advantage, that they wouldn't have to pay for. And money talks. And so that was the incentive of what was driving the city government here in New York to push all these people. Now, interestingly, about 4 months ago, I guess it is now, I got a call from a retiree in Delaware, a former teacher who had worked for the, a professor who worked for the state, a pensioner from Delaware State, who said, I read about this case in New York. They're trying to do the same thing to us here in Delaware. Can you help us? And in fact, with the same colleagues, Sarah Mark and Jake Gardner, who really are the brains behind this whole thing, we sued the state of Delaware on behalf of 32,000 Delaware pensioners and won that case as well. Now, totally different basis for winning, but we won. I have since gotten calls from retirees from IBM, from Colgate, from AT&T, from a major union in Maryland, all are experiencing the same thing. Their former employers are trying to move them out of the insurance, traditional Medicare plus supplemental, that they've had for years and years, and into a Medicare Advantage plan. Why? The same reason. The lure of that found money. Move it from our budget to the federal budget, and don't worry if it's not as good. And here's where we come down to the concern that the retirees legitimately have is Medicare Advantage is not as good because doctors don't participate. They have to go through this prior authorization BS, and the health outcomes are worse. And here's the irony. Medicare Advantage is more expensive than traditional Medicare and supplemental. It's consuming a larger proportion of the budget than the number of people who have it. And that led me to try to figure out, is there somewhere we can go? Is there a new program, a new variation, a new flavor on Medicare Advantage that would still use federal funds, but wouldn't have the downside and the risks of prior authorization? And the answer is maybe, or at least I hope so. But the answer is maybe, and I've now proposed it to New York City, to Delaware, and I'm trying to get people who are way smarter than me to say, hey, let's look and see if we can do something already approved by Congress to tap the Medicare Advantage $1,000 a month per person that doesn't have the same downside of prior authorization. And I call this idea Medicare Part F for future. People talk about Medicare Part E, but nobody has really come. So I wanted to jump over E anyway. Remember, we have A, B, C, and D as the drugs, and E would be the next one. But I like F better. So I call it Medicare F for future. And this, too, would be a public-private partnership, but take away from the private insurance companies the power they have to deny service, to deny tests, to deny procedures through prior authorization. Let them truly try to innovate. And we've seen medical innovation in the last couple of years because of COVID. Significant. Look, you know, Operation Warp Speed was a public-private partnership that, you know, came out with how many successful vaccinations in an extraordinarily short period of time? Telehealth has just, you know, just gone crazy. You know, I can get a, you know, a doctor or a physician's assistant on the phone, on a Zoom call in a matter of minutes, rather than having to wait to see someone in person for things that I don't really need to see them in person. I think the private sector can innovate. but we have to give them the right incentives and take away the tools that they're abusing, like prior authorization. So I'm pushing for something we're calling Medicare Part F, federal funds, private participation, but with better oversight so there aren't as many abuses.
And sometimes I think we present things or people see things and depends on what news outlets you look at, what you read. Whether you look at it is just trying to bump off granny, and we don't want that. I'm getting close to that granny age. I don't want somebody to bump me off. So I'm afraid, sadly, we have to bump you off the air because our time is up. I can't believe our hour has gone so fast. And you have to give everybody your website, where they can go and find out about your law firm, because they may have these similar issues in other states. And that's request number one. Request number two is come back to talk some more about some whole variety of healthcare issues. So please do.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed this enormously. Thank you, really.
Well,
the firm is called Pollock Cohen, PollockCohen.com. We're here in New York City, although we have offices in California. We have an office in Philadelphia as well. And, you know, I love to talk to people and hear what's on people's minds, hear what their problems are. I can't, most often I can't help people, but I can at least afford a reasonable ear and give some guidance. So thank you for having me.
Okay. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. I hope you learned a lot. I sure did. And remember that we do have our new feature that are questions that you can send in to americaoutloud.com/pulse. And it can be to the host, a guest. The host can try to hunt down the guest and get an answer. First names are fine. And we'll either email you right back or give the answer on the air or both. And remember, we have a new show, Nurses Out Loud, and that's also Monday through Friday with different hosts. So I just want to say, whether you agree or have other opinions of what you've heard on the show, share the show anyway. And as always, thanks for listening to America Out Loud Pulse. Always a beat ahead. And so until next week, say it loud. I'm free and I'm proud.